Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Last Friday, the U.S. Coast Guard reported that it detained Lieutenant Christopher Paul Hassan after discovering what amounted to a planned terrorist plot, including an intent to kill journalists and prominent Democratic members of Congress. Hassan amassed a stockpile of some 15 weapons and left an extensive online trail affirming his commitment to white nationalism and his desire to incite a race war. The thwarted attack fits in with a disturbing rise in domestic extremism, and it raises even more questions about whether past and current military members are more susceptible to this type of radicalization. Joining us now is Janet Reitman, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and Rolling Stone, and she's also working on an upcoming book on white supremacy. Janet, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So when we look at this specific incident, what does this tell you about how the military deals or doesn't deal with domestic terrorism in its own ranks?
I mean, I think that it's worthwhile pointing out that, you know, my understanding is the Coast Guard did, in fact, look into this and was alerted to this early. You know, so that's encouraging. But it's important to point out that the military has a rule that allegedly is supposed to bar anyone who belongs to gangs, which would include white supremacist type gangs, skinhead gangs, from joining. So if you have a swastika tattoo, you're not supposed to be able to join the U.S. military. If you have a history of being a part of a skinhead gang, you're not supposed to be able to join the U.S. military. This guy Hassan, he actually had been a skinhead like 30 years ago, according to his own letters.
But despite all that, in 2017, there was a Military Times study that found that 25%, so one quarter of service members, had been at least exposed to white nationalism while serving in the military.
Yeah.
Is there something about military culture that draws these types of extremists?
I mean, military culture is, I would say that, you know, first of all, this 25% number, which I have also used and take seriously, that's not to say that one quarter of the U.S. military happened to be a white nationalist. And I think that's often, you know, interpreted in that way, that statistic. I don't think that's the case. I mean, I don't have any evidence that that's the case. But what I do think is that the white supremacist movement for years and years and years has encouraged people to join the U.S. military to get training for the upcoming racial holy war, right? This is, you know, their training for what they anticipate will be their great conflict. So that is, you know, certainly something that's been true for, you know, really for decades.
And what you're describing, again, sounds similar to a lot of the radical Islamic groups that we talk about,
yeah,
but the narrative here often isn't the same, right? The way we describe these groups often in the United States isn't the same. But
yeah,
you're describing something that's almost the holy war image that comes into mind right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that both, you know, Islamic extremist groups like ISIS and far right extremist groups or far right extremist individuals, they have many of the same fundamental drivers and recruit in many of the same ways and in many of the same venues and appeal to young people using many of the same methods and are treated absolutely diametrically differently. I mean, there is an absolute polar difference between the way these two groups of people are treated. If this had been a darker skinned individual, if this had been an African American or, you know, a Muslim American member of the U.S. military who was planning an act of domestic terror and had those weapons and had all of those same points, all of those same data points were
true. And a detailed list.
That
targets.
Whole thing of it. If all those data points were the same, but this happened to be a guy from a Sunni Muslim background, forget it, man. This would, you know how many journalists would be on this case? I mean, I reported on the Boston bombing, and I can tell you the competition, you know, and that was obviously an act of terror.
So what happened? Where was the media?
I have no idea. I mean, I was, you know, same thing. Like, it was, you know, people that covered, you know, extremism and terrorism were freaking out about this. You know, so particularly the journalists in the national security community all understood this was like a major deal. And, you know, the story has died. This thing about Jussie Smollett, mm-hmm. like that, that's the story that was above the fold, right? And so it's baffling, not surprising, but it still kind of just boggles the mind that...
And it's fallen off, I mean.
Yeah, it's fallen yeah. off. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not, you know, okay, what's going on with the case right now is there is a two-week period during which investigators basically have to get more evidence of his being a national security threat. And there's been this big push right now.
Wait, let me just pause mm-hmm. right there, because wait, if I have a weapons stockpile at home and I am trained in how to use those weapons and I am, or, you know, whatever we want to call them, firearms, what have you, and I have a list of people who I want to kill with those firearms, at what point am I not a national security threat?
I mean, that, well, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. But they, I mean, they have him on these weapons and drug charges, and I think they need to, I mean, I don't, the rationale was we will hold him for 2 weeks and see what you can give us in 2 weeks.
Can we, let's talk more specifically even, because we talked about the media, we talked about the way we sort of look at this, but the we here, is there a connection between the rhetoric that we've heard for the past 2 years, and I'm not suggesting that racism and white supremacy and white nationalism suddenly, you know, came about in 2016. That's not the case. That's, our country has often been, you know, that's rooted in our country. But has the rhetoric, has the openness of white nationalism, this sort of resurgence of it so openly, contributed to what we're seeing today?
I think so. I mean, I think it's a couple of things. I think, first of all, you know, the role of technology, which everybody points out, but, you know, Twitter and Gab and these platforms, it's not only that there are online platforms, it's that there are a lot of them, and they continue to just pop up when one goes away. But I do think that this, you know, the rhetoric that came out of the 2016 presidential campaign and the whole emergence of Donald Trump and the way that he has played to a certain base has absolutely contributed to this. And you see that, you know, for example, you see in this guy, one of his little points was that he was researching was, you know, civil war if Trump is impeached. I mean, there's, you know, there's a lot of linking this president to larger white nationalist agendas, even though, in fact, many white nationalists and neo-Nazis do not actually see Donald Trump as one of them. He is a tool for them. He did not create them. They think that they would judge him harshly because he has a Jewish son-in-law and his daughter converted to Judaism. And all of a sudden, you would see that you see these white nationalist types being like, wait a minute, he's saying what we've been saying for years. Like, so great. Let's let him keep saying it. I mean, seriously, he's empowered their rhetoric in a way that I don't think they would have ever imagined.
Janet Reitman is a contributing writer for The New York Times Magazine and Rolling Stone. She's currently working on a book about white supremacy post 9/11. Janet, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.